the same time.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Hannah Gordon reads episode 3 of Martin Stannard's biography of the writer Muriel Spark. Having fled a disastrous marriage, Spark has left her son in the care of her parents in Edinburgh. Determined to pursue a career in letters, she's moved to London and is juggling life as a secretary with work as a literary critic.
In the autumn of 1951, Muriel noticed an advertisement for a Christmas story competition in The Observer. She had no aspirations to be a writer of prose fiction, but the prize was £250, and she was poor. She thought she might as well have a go, wrote it quickly, scrounged some typing paper from a local shop, posted her entry and forgot all about it. 2 months later, she answered the telephone, anxious that it might be a dentist dunning her for unpaid bills, and heard the voice of Philip Toynbee, the newspaper's literary editor. She had won the competition, beating nearly 7,000 other entries. Suddenly, she was famous. In the small hours of the morning of publication, the 23rd of December, David Astor, the editor, banged on her door to deliver the first copy himself. On Christmas Day, she was with her lover, Derek Stanford, toasting her good fortune. The telephone rang incessantly, with congratulations from friends and from other editors seeking her work. The story was The Seraph and the Zambezi, and it was a glass of postmodern champagne among the musty realism of the other entries. It was sparkling, fresh, possibly the first example by a British author of what became known as magical realism. Her biography of the poet laureate John Masefield, completed in February 1952, was the last book Muriel wrote as an agnostic. In January, just after her Observer success, she had contacted Father Ambrose Aegis, a Benedictine monk and poet she had known from her time as General Secretary of the Poetry Society, inquiring about predestination and free will. During March, a visit to Edinburgh had been typically provocative, Sissy irritating her with advice and the desire to show her daughter off among the Brunsfield Place gossips. Muriel's amused discontent had soon deepened to fury. Feeling suffocated and alienated from her son Robin, she buried herself in reading Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu. Robin had always presented Muriel with difficulties. Although she refused to feel guilty about leaving him in the care of her parents, she was protective of the boy and of his image of her. She wanted the best for him, sought to defend him from the influence of his father, Ozzy, and worried about his progress. In her role as distant organiser and protector, she was content to be doing her duty, but as she was moving towards Christianity, Robin had aligned himself with Judaism. On the 13th of January 1952, he had celebrated his bar mitzvah. Delighted for him to have something in which to believe, Muriel had paid for it with £50 from her Observer prize. Knowing that Ozzy would be there, she had not attended. Muriel was entering a period of massive mental reorganisation. Her poetry collection, The Fanfarlo and Other Verse, had just been published when, on the 26th of July 1952, she went to see an Anglican priest, the vicar of St Augustine's in Kensington. Increasingly, she had felt the need to attend a church, and Stanford had sometimes accompanied her, sitting awkwardly behind a pillar at the back. Muriel was plagued by discordant emotions. Her anxieties about possible marriage to Stanford confronted her sense of spiritual release. Celibacy cleared her mind, yet appeared to condemn her to solitude. It all compounded a terrible sense of things running out of control in her life. In the light of Muriel's religious transformation, her critical writing from this period appears strikingly personal. she shot off to the Edinburgh Festival aboard the Flying Scotsman as correspondent for the Church of England newspaper to review, amongst other things, the first run of T.S. Eliot's The Confidential Clerk. Although she did not realise it at the time, that journey to Edinburgh was a Victoria Falls in her life, beyond which all was utterly transformed. Immediately, the play became an obsession. It has, she wrote, to do with faithfulness and idolatry, security and rootlessness, vague desires and precise fulfilments, parents and children, art and craft, success and failure. It had, in short, to do with all the theological, aesthetic and domestic paradoxes that were pulling her apart. Muriel spent Christmas of 1953 with Roy Foster, her Anglican vicar at St. Augustine's. It was another turning point. The new year had inaugurated Muriel's formal instruction at Ealing Priory under Father Aegis, and she was received into the Roman Catholic Church on the 1st of May, 1954. "I was so pleased to hear you were so happy," he wrote. "You looked radiant." Happiness and radiance, however, had scarcely characterised her previous 6 months. Eliot's play tormented her, and she went to see it again in London. Somehow it now spoke to her even more directly. She began to research Eliot's work meticulously. For some months she had been innocently popping dexedrine, then readily available from chemist shops to assist dieting. It seemed an ideal drug to get her through this difficult time. She economised on food, lost weight, and her wits were sharpened for those long working nights. 3 books to write, reviews, poems, letters, and reading, reading, reading. Theological and aesthetic ideas jangled around the anxieties about Stanford, her family, and not least the attempt to live on a tiny and erratic income. Then, shortly after she began her Catholic instruction, around the 15th to the 20th of January 1954, something went badly wrong. Her friends noticed the trouble before she did. T.S. Eliot, she insisted, was sending her threatening messages. His play was full of them. Some were in the theatre programme. Obsessively, she began to seek them out, covering sheet after sheet of paper with anagrams and cryptographic experiments. "So far as I am able to describe my condition," Muriel wrote in May 1954, "now that I am recovered, of course it seems to me rather absurd, but it was very real at the time. Briefly, the trouble was that I began to imagine secret codes in everything I read, even in the press." This letter was to the Ministry of National Insurance, which had disallowed her claim for national health benefit. Half the stamps for 1953 were missing, and by mid-January 1954, so also was half her mind. But she did not panic, simply tried to battle her own way out of the nightmare, wrote nothing, and lived off loans. The physiological cause of the hallucinations was straightforward. She was suffering, as her future supporter Evelyn Waugh was in early 1954, from drug poisoning. Dexedrine, now known as speed, is an upper. When she stopped taking it, the delusions slowly evaporated. Evelyn Waugh coped with his illness by writing it up as the ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold, 1957. Muriel was doing much the same thing with her first novel, The Comforters. The story centres on Caroline Rose, a young Catholic convert who, on religious grounds, has stopped sleeping with her lover, Lawrence Manders. She suffers a nervous breakdown and retires to a retreat house. She is a literary critic who has written a treatise on the novel and is now writing a novel herself. Caroline suffers delusions, appearing to herself as a character in the novel we are reading. A typewriter taps in her head, speaking the narrative of her life, predicting it. Torn between the spiritual and the material worlds, she goes mad, and can only reunite the two halves of her psyche in fiction. This was precisely Muriel's dilemma. It was this inability to distinguish inside from outside, fact from fiction, which was at once terrifying and stimulating to both War and Muriel, and writing the novel was integral to her recovery. By the end of May 1955, Muriel sent 5 chapters of what was to become The Comforters to her editor at Macmillan, Alan MacLean. He replied quickly, concerned that Caroline's voices should not dominate the whole narrative, and immediately commissioned a short story for the Winter's Tale series he had started. The theme of her Winter's Tale story remained obscure, but she had the first sentence. "One day, in my young youth at high summer, lolling with my lovely companions against a haystack, I found a needle. And with the exception of against, for upon, this became the opening line of one of the 20th century's finest short fictions, The Portobello Road." Later, she often worked like this. A sentence would form, a title, and a network of metaphors would crystallise around it. No plan, no argument, and definitely no change of title. With The Portobello Road, Muriel had found her mature voice. There were no more relapses, and the novel sped ahead to completion. She finished The Comforters, then wrote in quick succession Robinson, 1958, Memento Mori, 1959, The Ballad of Peckham Rye, 1960, and The Bachelors, 1960. All brilliantly original works that stormed the literary citadels. Usually she had one book finished while another was in proof and a third being launched. Macmillan could hardly keep up. Inevitably, The Comforters met with some bafflement. In the vast majority of reviews, however, Muriel's brainchild met with huge acclaim. Coverage was excellent for a first novel. Graham Greene called it one of the few really original first novels one has read for many years. But the best of the bunch was The Spectator's full-page eulogy from War. "It so happens," War wrote, "that The Comforters came to me just as I had finished a story on a similar theme, and I was struck by how much more ambitious was Miss Sparks' essay, and how much better she had accomplished it." With Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh, Muriel Spark completed a grand triumvirate of Catholic convert novelists. All were exiles looking to the church for a home. But in one particular, she was radically different from both her supporters. They were products of the Oxford-educated bourgeoisie. She had fought her way into their intellectual company through sheer force of talent and lived precariously in 2 attic rooms. She was also half-Jewish. The consciousness of exile was to her not the 1950s angst typical of post-war writers, but an inbred cultural dynamic. Cultural dislocation was not a mournful condition. She nurtured it, walking out of one existence, closing the door, and into another. So, here she was, in February 1957, finally liberated at the age of 39. Acknowledged, justified, her mind boiling with books. She was a full-time writer. This time, she determined, there was to be no turning back.
Hannah Gordon reading Muriel Spark, the biography by Martin Stannard. It was abridged by Rosemary Goring and produced by Kirsteen Cameron. Tomorrow, Spark receives critical and commercial success on both sides of the Atlantic for her novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock now, and our drama for this hour is based on Margaret Oliphant's novel.